Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and the two nominating conventions get underway next week. First up, the Democrats, then the following week, the Republicans, and of course, these are the candidates' big chances to energize their campaigns and their supporters as we head into fall and the long push to Election Day. Now, for most voters, it's just a television spectacle. For party insiders, they're like any other industry conventions, right? Chances to schmooze and party and have balloons, a lot of balloons, rain down on you from the rafters after that last speech by the nominee. This year, the pandemic has, of course, upended a lot of that. No crowds, no applause, travel is out, and Zoom is in for the conventions and probably the rest of the campaign season. So how are the candidates reaching voters, and does this crisis present an opportunity to change the way we conduct campaigns? We saw some of it yesterday when Joe Biden formally introduced Kamala Harris as his running mate with no applause or crowd energy to feed off of, right? To explore this further, I'm joined by two reporters with some experience on the campaign trail, Elizabeth Drew, Washington-based journalist and author of Washington Journal, Reporting Watergate and Richard Nixon's Downfall, which was reissued in 2014. She recently wrote an opinion piece for the New York Times saying, "Let's scrap the presidential debates." Also with us is Molly Ball, Time Magazine's national political correspondent, whose biography of the House Speaker came out this year, titled Pelosi. Her article in this week's issue of Time is called How COVID-19 Changed Everything About the 2020 Election. Molly and Elizabeth, welcome back to WNYC. Hi.
Hi. Hi, great to be here.
And you've both covered national politics extensively, but Elizabeth Drew, your first campaign, I see, was 1968. And let me mention that listeners we'll be able to hear you talk about that campaign on tomorrow's show, that Summer Friday special I was talking about when we revisit our series, The Eights. You are our guest, along with the now late, great Cokie Roberts, as we trace the developments in the culture wars through Nixon's election that year. Maybe you remember coming on with us 2 years ago for that. And Nixon is tied to one big change in campaigning, television, when he was seen to have lost the televised debates or debate, one in particular in 1960 against JFK, because of how they compared on TV screens. While Molly Ball, your first appearance on C-SPAN anyway, was in 2008, and Obama's campaign was seen as a game changer in the way it used social media. So let's talk about kind of entering this in 1968 and entering this in 2008 and compare notes. Elizabeth, how different is it today? What should we take away from what they did in 1968?
Well, I'm interested in your point that this is another opportunity to pause and rethink these processes. Full disclosure, Molly and I are friends and mutual admirers, so I'm delighted to be on with her today. The campaigns themselves, this is from when candidates had to run around to the various cities. It was exhausting. It probably led to illnesses, and it took an awful lot of time and expense. That needs to be rethought. I definitely think, you know, as I wrote in the Times, that the debates, I think they are debates. We can get into that later. And it's certainly the conventions, you called them the nominating conventions, and it's true, but the nominations are settled. The platforms are settled. So we need to rethink, what are these about? What are they for? And it's a lot of speeches, but the television audience doesn't really want to see very many of them. So I think the whole thing is open now. We now have Zoom. We have all sorts of other ways to communicate. And the whole thing, to me, is open for a rethink.
Yeah, Molly, I was struck, actually, yesterday watching the Biden-Harris event, how the TV correspondents on various networks who were at the scene or outside the scene were talking about how different this was for the reasons that I mentioned in the intro, not having the crowds, not having the applause. But to me as a TV viewer, I wouldn't have noticed that, I don't think, if the correspondents weren't telling it to me. So maybe we're going to have the same experience as viewers next week and the following week with the conventions. As far as people are concerned anyway, most people around the country, these are just a series of primetime televised speeches.
I think that's right. And it's great to be on with my dear friend and mentor, Elizabeth, who I disagree with about the debates, but agree with on most other things. And I do agree with her that this is an opportunity to rethink a lot of things, including things like, you know, mass audience events and conventions. It didn't feel all that different watching that speech on TV when what you're used to as a viewer is watching things on TV. And I think the comparison, Brian, that you drew to industry conventions is a good one. I think that the conventions, their main benefit is for the insiders, is for the people who attend them. It isn't necessarily a great informational event versus just sort of an infomercial for the rest of the country that's sitting home trying to decide, you know, what candidate to vote for. And I think the proof of that is that they don't have that much of an impact, right? We've seen, if you look at polling, this idea that candidates get a sort of convention bounce, right? Because that's their big introduction to the country. That's been less and less true in recent years. The campaigns are so well covered, and people who are curious about the candidates have so many ways to find that information that the conventions don't move the needle all that much. I was thinking about 4 years ago when the Republican convention was widely agreed to be a disaster, right? The speeches were weird or dark. There were all kinds of logistical problems. And there was a divided party that was sort of on display with Ted Cruz being booed off stage and so forth. Mm. And yet, of course, Donald Trump won the election. And so it doesn't really seem to matter whether you put on a good show for the nation, or maybe that show itself was informative to people who wanted that. But it is mainly a spectacle, and I think that we should calibrate our expectations accordingly. I'm not against spectacle in and of itself, but I think just like a lot of things that the pandemic has sort of highlighted, whether it's people's ability to work remotely or various challenges with education, this is an opportunity to go back to the drawing board and think about the ways we can use particularly technology to revamp a lot of these old processes.
So let me skip ahead of the conventions, Elizabeth, because the conventions may make a lot of people shrug and say, oh, we already know who the nominee is. Yeah, I watched some of the speeches. Eh. And to your point of your op-ed, which is a much more radical idea, let's scrap the presidential debates, the televised debates. Why?
Because they don't test. They test the wrong thing. They test who does the best one-liner, the best put-down. They don't test the things that we really look for or should be looking for in a president. A president doesn't spend a whole lot of time putting down a member of Congress or a foreign leader. What we want is to know what they think or what they would do. If we could revise the debates, make them debates, then I'd be fine with it. But they aren't debates. I'm afraid too many of the questions are press conference questions. They really are aimed at one particular candidate and not something that's not a debate question. I just think they've gone off the rails. The Kennedy-Nixon debate, the first one, was a much more substantive debate, but they've declined since then.
Molly, you said you disagree with Elizabeth on this. How come?
Well, I think we do agree that the debates could be done better. I think debates, like any political happening, can be done well or poorly. And in the, I think it ended up being 1.2 million Democratic primary debates this year. Is that the correct number? There were some of them that were very good and enlightening and informative, and others that were not. And that depends to some degree on the moderators and their skill. I also agree with Elizabeth that the ways we think of what the debates are for could be improved, because there is a lot of this sort of angels on the head of a pin, dissecting of people's positions in ways that have no relation to the actual job of the president, which is not to take finely calibrated policy positions, but to govern. So I do think a reorientation of the debate toward those questions of practical governance could make them more informative. That being said, you know, you started this conversation by asking what's changed since we started covering politics. Mm-hmm. And my experience is quite a bit shorter than Elizabeth's, but the main thing that's changed is just we have so fewer opportunities in the media to actually ask the candidates questions. Campaigns have become more and more controlled, more and more hermetically sealed. And it is certainly true that the candidates can use debates to get off a sort of canned one-liner, but they do, on some level, have to think on their feet and have to perform in a non-controlled environment. And I am for as many of those types of experiences for us in the media and for the public as we can possibly get.
You want to keep going, Elizabeth?
Well, a number of people got a big reaction to the piece. I was accused of shilling for Biden on the fantasy on the right that Biden is afraid of debating His name is Trump.
Yeah.
And so I was really
the Trump, accusation but now was it's I was Trump.
Yeah, I think so. Still Trump. That I was shilling for Biden, and Biden was so afraid to debate Trump. And it had nothing to do with it. It had nothing to do with who the candidates are. I've felt this way for some time. I've moderated some debates. Mm-hmm. And I did one where I insisted on debate questions, and I got a lot of grief in the press who always were too polite because they want the mud wrestling. They want the crowd in the Coliseum. I think Molly and I agree more than we disagree. The debates value the wrong thing. Some people did suggest that we have a series of... I take Molly's point completely, but the questions you ask a candidate aren't necessarily debate questions. Some people suggested having a series of town halls, which might be a good idea. I'm all for exposing the candidates, but I don't think these debates test the right qualities in what we should be looking for in a president. And it's no accident that even though last time Mrs. Clinton was seen to, on the substance, win, Trump was the better showman. And it's really about putting on a show.
Listeners, we can take a few phone calls for political reporters Molly Ball and Elizabeth Drew. You can address Elizabeth's proposition directly. Maybe you saw her New York Times op-ed called "Let's Scrap the Presidential Debates." Do you think yes or no, or can they be modified in some way to make them more meaningful to what really matters or should matter to the electorate and what makes a good president, or anything else you want to say about changing the way the campaigns are run, maybe taking the opportunity of the limitations of this year of COVID-19 to change some things permanently that might be for the better. 646-435-7280, and let's take a phone call right now. Alan in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Alan.
Good morning. Thank you, and keep up all the good work. I have two comments on the suggestion that the conventions are no longer needed. First of all, the president has commanded hundreds of hours of unscripted, totally contentless airtime since COVID began, supposedly to inform the public about the disease and steps being taken to control it, and he's turned them into campaign rallies with very little substance. If the networks have time to broadcast those empty hours, they certainly have time every 4 years to broadcast something that's been organized by the parties to make the best case for each candidate's election for president. Secondly, on the question of the substance of what's being said, when you have less of the kind of audience that creates a backdrop, like an Emperor's New Clothes crowd where people are encouraged to believe something because the crowd says there are a lot of us, you must agree with us, having an audience absent from the stage of the convention means that people have to focus on the words and decide whether they agree with the words themselves and not be convinced because they see a mob of people who must be right. So in a way, it's a better format. Mm-hmm. Trump has maximized the exploitation of wallpapers of faces behind him at rallies, not because what he's saying is worthwhile, but because he thinks that people seeing a lot of faces behind him will convince ordinary viewers who think in a lazy way that he must be right because all those people agree with him.
You know, Alan, I'm going to leave it there and get a response. Molly, you want to take any of that?
I think I mostly agree. I think this question of whether or not to have an audience is a really interesting one. We are, you know, as humans, social creatures, and politics is at its core an act of communication. between candidates and voters as they try to persuade them. And I think that's why it is so surreal to watch these speeches in sort of an empty room where you can hear a pin drop, and why you sometimes see people saying, well, can't we have like a laugh track, right? Like a sitcom style, because we do, we want to not just take in information in a vacuum, but see how others are responding to that information in real time. So it does become a sort of surreal experience. Maybe we'll get used to it if that becomes the norm. But it definitely strikes me as disorienting, and it'll be interesting to see as the parties figure out their presentations this year, what, if anything, they do to try to address that sort of creepiness that I think is inherent when you're just giving a speech to an empty room.
And I think the caller makes a good point about all the TV time that the president has been able to commandeer during COVID on cable TV by holding news conferences, which are half the time not COVID information, but really campaign events. And the other side, whoever the other side turns out to be, and of course, in this case, it's Joe Biden, doesn't have that advantage. So they get a little meaningful exposure in a televised convention speech. So that, out of a sense of fairness, might be in the long run a good thing. You know, it's interesting. We're getting a number of phone calls from people who are involved in formal debate societies of one kind or another. The president of something called sciencedebate.org, which does it in a certain way. But I want to take Tom in New Jersey, who says he's a college debater and wants to compare his experience, I think, to what the televised presidential debates are. Tom, you're on WNYC. Thanks so much for calling in.
Yeah, thanks, Brian. No, my point is quick. I was a college debater. I am not now.
That's
This, I have been saying for years, watching these things very closely, I'm a political junkie, that these are nothing more than dual press conferences. There's nothing that remotely resembles a debate between two people, from my experience, and I debated all 4 years of college, and it just doesn't resemble it at all. So that was the only point I really wanted to make. Thanks so much.
Tom, thank you very much. Let's go to Sheila in Westchester. Sheila, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi, good morning, Brian. Thanks for taking my call. I think that conventions matter for three reasons. One, the 2004 Democrat National Convention catapulted Barack Obama onto the national stage. I had chills when I heard that speech. It's an opportunity not just for the candidates running for president, but for rising stars in the party and future stars of the party. Secondly, it's an opportunity for voters who don't have time to go onto the candidate events to take time and watch, you know, watch something on the news. Third, that.
And I think Sheila's breaking up too bad to keep going. But her main point is very clear. And Elizabeth, I was going to push back on your let's cancel the debates idea with pretty much the same thing that Sheila is arguing here, which is just that it's an opportunity, and she's talking about the conventions even,
right,
as an opportunity when people's attention is galvanized, because it's television, because it's primetime television, just to get people engaged with the political process. And in the case she points out from 2004, to let a rising star like Barack Obama have a national platform that helps people see what he can do, at least what he can say. And I was thinking that even with the debates, or especially with the debates, compared to, say, if both of the candidates just had more news conferences or CNN-style town halls, there are plenty of those, and they don't get the viewership that the three big presidential debates, the official ones, get. And so a lot of people, if we have a problem in this country of people not being engaged enough with the political process to be informed enough at a decent level of detail, at least there are those big tentpole kind of events of the three televised presidential debates. And maybe they could be improved substantially, but maybe that's what we should be talking about, how to make the televised debate something more and better than parallel talking sound bites, rather than scrapping them.
Well, here's the dirty little secret, Brian. The candidates, the campaigns have the thumbs on what are going to be the procedures on the debates.
Yeah,
in other words, the debates we have are the ones the candidates want. They like the one-liners. They don't want to have to do the substantive back and forth. And so that's your first call. You said these aren't debates, and he's absolutely right. If we could have college-style debates, if we could have ones that are real, and if we could also prevail upon the people who ask the questions to ask debate questions, then they'd be much more worthwhile. What I'm concerned about is they have descended into who does the best one-liner, and it has an effect on the campaigns, and that's not what we should be looking for in a president. So they've distorted the process. So it's not just that they aren't debates. They have a bad effect, an unfortunate effect, I think, on the elections themselves because of what the values are. Of course, people like to see the mud wrestling. They like the fights in the Coliseum, but that isn't what we should be looking for. We're looking for the wrong things in these debates.
Molly, as we run out of time, can you give us one piece of reporting as kind of a follow-up on something that Elizabeth said before? She talked about the myth or the fiction that the Trump campaign is putting out that Biden doesn't want to debate. Is there any serious discussion about scrapping any of the three presidential debates that are scheduled for September and October? They come out of this official debate commission, which has existed for a long time, and as Elizabeth says accurately, is run by the two parties. So they set up the debate rules, they set up the debate dates, all of that stuff. The president, I know, is asking for more debates. I think that's A, because he's behind in the polls, and usually whoever's losing wants more debates. B, because he thinks he will do a better job than Joe Biden at these. But is there any serious talk about not having the three that are scheduled?
The short answer is no. And the longer answer is no. The Biden campaign has not suggested that it might pull out of the debates, even though, as you suggest, that is a relatively common thing for people who are ahead in the polls to do, is to not create new opportunities for errors or gaffes as long as they are ahead. I think the Trump campaign is also not insane to want more opportunities to debate. They've particularly cited the availability of early voting, that people could be casting votes They'd had an opportunity to hear from the candidates. And so that wouldn't necessarily be the worst thing in the world, but it's been received as a sort of trollish suggestion for the reasons that you cite, that they do seem to be trying to just to draw Biden into a circumstance where they're suggesting that he won't be up to snuff. And as Elizabeth said earlier, we don't actually have any reason to believe that. So we shall see.
We shall see. Yeah, I guess maybe there is a point to starting the debates earlier, given when early voting starts in a number of states, but we will leave it there. Elizabeth Drew, Washington-based journalist and author of Washington Journal, reporting Watergate and Richard Nixon's downfall, which was reissued in 2014, and Molly Ball, Time Magazine's national political correspondent and author of the recently released book, Pelosi. And listeners, remember to tune in tomorrow for our Summer Friday special rebroadcast of highlights from the Culture Wars series that we did, a history series on this show called The Eights, to hear Elizabeth Drew and Cokie Roberts in what turned out to be Cokie's final appearance on the show, with a fascinating conversation with the echoes of 1968's presidential election. Thank you both very much for coming on, Molly and Elizabeth. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Brian.